From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with comic Bernie Mac, one of the stars of the Spike Lee performance film The Original Kings of Comedy. On the new Fox sitcom, The Bernie Mac Show, he plays a fictional version of himself who's raising the three children of his drug-addicted sister. Bernie Mac used to perform on HBO's Russell Simmons Deaf Comedy Jam. Later we'll meet Simmons, the leading entrepreneur of hip-hop. After launching the careers of Curtis Blow and Run DMC, he co-founded Def Jam Records, which signed Public Enemy, the Beastie Boys, LL Cool J. He's produced movies and TV shows, and even has his own line of clothing and perfume. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. U.S. military officials say 30 to 40 men are still holding out against Northern Alliance forces in a prison complex in northern Afghanistan. Foreign fighters loyal to Osama bin Laden staged an uprising on Sunday. A United Nations-sponsored meeting on establishing a new governing coalition in Afghanistan has been delayed. The sides are meeting in Germany. The BBC's Barnaby Mason reports from Bonn.
The UN spokesman said the postponement of a planned session between the Afghan delegates and the conference chairman, Mr. Brahimi, should not be interpreted as a sign that the talks had already run into trouble. It was simply that the representatives of the Afghan factions needed more time to confer among themselves. A similar explanation was offered by a member of a Pashtun group based in Pakistan, Dr. Anwar-ul-Haq Ahadi. He said it was better at this stage to discuss the issues informally rather than take up firm stances in a formal meeting, which it was then hard to change.
The BBC's Barnaby Mason in Bonn. The commander of the American war in Afghanistan says the U.S. has identified a number of sites where Osama bin Laden may have been researching chemical, biological, or nuclear weapons. General Tommy Frank says there are more than 40 such sites now under the control of anti-Taliban forces. Attorney General John Ashcroft says more than 550 people are being held on immigration violations or other federal charges, and he says some members of Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda network may be among them. The Attorney General's announcement was the first accounting of people in federal custody in several weeks. Ashcroft says he still will not release their names. The announcement comes amid concerns in Congress and among civil rights groups about the secrecy surrounding those who have been detained. Ashcroft defends the secrecy, saying he's concerned about the privacy of people who are still in custody but may be innocent. Transportation Secretary Norman Mineta drew criticism today from Capitol Hill after announcing the government will not meet a 60-day deadline for screening all baggage loaded onto airliners. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
The aviation security bill President Bush signed into law last week gives authorities only until mid-January to start screening all airline baggage. But Secretary Mineta said perhaps only a certain percentage of bags could actually be screened by then. Republican Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison, the chief sponsor of the aviation security bill, said it was premature of Mineta to say he can't meet the deadline only a week after the bill became law.
And I'm calling on him to look more carefully at all of the options and before he says he can't meet the deadline, to please try harder to do something that is very important for the safety of the traveling public.
House Democratic leader Dick Gephardt suggested using National Guard troops posted at airports to help screen baggage and meet the January deadline. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
You're listening to news from National Public Radio. Connecticut is joining seven other states in rejecting a settlement in the antitrust case against Microsoft. Heather Claiborne of WNPR reports.
The proposed settlement would require Microsoft to give independent monitors full access to its books and plans for the next 5 years, as well as providing information to help rivals make their products more compatible with Windows. It would also give computer manufacturers more freedom to replace Windows features with competing products. Connecticut Attorney General Richard Blumenthal says while the deal reflects good progress, it has too many gaps.
The settlement achieved so far simply doesn't restore competition, doesn't prevent the misconduct from recurring, and therefore needs to be strengthened.
A Microsoft spokesman says they believe the settlement is fair and reasonable, and while they're willing to clarify any questions, the company will not make any further concessions. For NPR News, I'm Heather Claiborne in Hartford.
A judge in Denver has dismissed all but one of the lawsuits brought by Columbine High School victims against law enforcement agencies. Federal Judge Lewis Babcock says authorities responded reasonably to what he called a rapidly evolving situation at the high school in Littleton. He says holding police officers liable for their responses to the massacre would paralyze the functions of law enforcement. Two students committed suicide after killing 12 students and a teacher and wounding more than two dozen others in 1999. Blowing drifting snow closed school for thousands of children from the Plain States to the Upper Great Lakes for a second day today. Wilmer, Minnesota had more than 28 inches of snow by noon. And a winter-like weather system reached Texas today with snow from the Panhandle to Lubbock to Wichita Falls. I'm Frank Stachow, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing customized approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America, on the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Bernie Mac, is the star of the new sitcom The Bernie Mac Show, in which he plays a fictional version of himself. Both Bernie Macs are stand-up comics. The real Bernie Mac became well-known through the Russell Simmons Deaf Comedy Jam on HBO and Spike Lee's performance film, The Original Kings of Comedy. Now he has a new book called I Ain't Scared of You. The new sitcom is loosely based on Bernie Mac's experiences raising his daughter, his niece, and his niece's child. On the show, Bernie Mac and his wife have just taken in his sister's three young children because his sister has a drug problem and is in rehab. In the first episode, Bernie Mac talks directly to the audience about his new situation.
America, let's talk.
Yeah, my sister's on drugs. That's okay. Some of your family members messed up, too. What am I supposed to do? Allow these three kids to go to the state or some foster home or some white couple? Hold on. This ain't about race. It's not about race. I just don't want to hear them talking all proper like that. You know what I'm saying? That's all I'm trying to say. Or they got to sit there and share food with 40 other kids. No, that ain't right. I'm trying to do the right thing.
Uncle Bernie loves the kids that he's now responsible for, but they're also driving him crazy.
I'm gonna kill one of them kids. Oh, don't get me wrong. I love them. They my blood. I give them the shirt off my back. You ever see a chicken with his neck run, laying to the side all lazy and weak? That's what I'm gonna do to them kids. Talk back to me one more time. Snap, I'm gonna snap their neck off. They're too sassy. They're too grown today. They talk back too much. Yeah, I know what you're saying to Mac. I don't care what you're talking about. Bernie Mac crew, Bernie Mac beat his kids. I don't care. That's your opinion. Because you don't know the story. You don't know what went down. And they're not my kids.
Now, in the TV show, the Bernie Mac character is not used to being a father. You know, he
right.
just inherited these three kids, and he's making a lot of mistakes. Now the most quoted line from the show so far is something he says to one of the kids. You know what the line is.
Yeah.
Why don't you say it?
I'll bust your head to the white meat show.
That's it.
Is that it?
Yeah. Because his impulse is always like, if the kids are misbehaving, hit them.
Well,
and he doesn't really do it, but that's the impulse.
Well, he's from the old school. I mean, he believed that iron with ruling with an iron hand. And, I mean, you have to understand something. He comes from a generation or a time period in the 70s and 60s where spankings were permitted. And discipline was of the high regard. Bernie Mac has no idea about parenting. And his way of parenting, he's still a disciplinarian. And he believes in his heart strongly that a kid should be a kid. And that's where the problem lies. He's not PC. He's not worried about image. He's living his life, and he's trying to save lives. And that's what makes the show so interesting, and that's what makes the humor. The humor is not punchline joke. That's something I didn't want.
You grew up on the south side of Chicago.
Yes, ma'am.
Describe where you grew up.
I grew up, I was born on 66 and Blackstone, and that building was torn down because it was rat infested. We couldn't play outside because the rats used to be in the walls on the banister. We stayed on the third floor, and my mom used to literally pick me up. I was 3 to 4 years old, and she would walk me three flights of stairs and kicking rats from my feet. The city tore the building down and moved us to 69th and Morgan. Well, that was a little bit better, supposedly, the Inglewood area in Chicago. And at 4 years old, that's when I, 4 to 5, decided I wanted to be a comedian, because I walked in from playing and I saw my mother sitting on in her favorite chair crying. And as a little kid, I saw her cry and I began to cry, like most kids often do. And I asked her why was she crying, and she told me nothing. At that particular time, Ed Sullivan was introducing Bill Cosby. Bill Cosby came out and he did a routine about rats and snakes in the bathroom. My mother began to laugh and cry at the same time. When I saw that, I started laughing with her. And I told my mom, I said, that's what I'm going to be, Mom. I'm going to be a comedian. So I'll never have to see you cry again. Because at that particular time, I thought comedians relieved my mother of her pain. And that's something that I always wanted to do.
So what were some of the jokes that went over real big when you were a boy?
I think none. I think that I was a struggling comic. But in my mind, I was successful. People said I was stupid. I was silly. They said I was buffoonish. I used to dress up, put on my mother wig, put on my grandmother slip coat. I used to dress up as a woman and portray as Bernice. That was one of the characters that I created as a young boy, was Bernice. And it wasn't about being a homosexual or anything like that. I was portraying a woman. And I used to talk like a woman, put on my grandmother glasses, and I used to mimic, y'all better quit playing up in here. Everybody better go to bed. I'm sick and tired of all this mess. Lord, Lord, Lord. And that's how my grandma used to talk.
All right. Who were the comics you loved to listen to when you were growing up?
Sweetheart, I was a student of the game. I had so many. I mean, from Richard Pryor, Red Fox, Moms Mabley, Pig Meat Markham, Jack Benny, Red Skelton, Johnny Carson, Steve Allen. Oh, I don't want to leave anybody out. Jackie Gleason was one of my favorites. Norm Crosby, Don Rickles.
What did you do to try to figure out what it is that they did that was so funny? You said earlier that you tried to do impressions of comics that you loved when you were young.
I watched what made them different. I watched what made them all successful in their own way. And what made them all successful was style. They had a unique style about themselves, not like today. You see one comic and he gets hot, that's what they want everyone to be like. They want everyone to be like that individual. Don Rickles, I was so impressed with Don Rickles, the way he can just come in and just destroy an entire room. That, I was so impressed. And I was not offended as a young boy watching this guy and some of the things, Jews, blacks, Chinese, or I mean, he tore you up, but you knew it was a joke. I got it right away. I was not offended. I was not saying, did you hear what he said? He was funny. Jackie Gleason was so impressive to me, whereas he never rehearsed. He ad-libbed so well. And he took the energy that he had was something that I wanted. That's a page of his notebook that I've taken.
How did you figure out who you were going to be on stage as a comic?
I didn't figure it out until 1987. It's just something that came to me. I combined them all. Richard Pryor showed me how to laugh at yourself. That was something that was unheard of, to laugh at your pain. Red Fox was nothing but Richard Pryor, but he was denied. Richard Pryor modified and moderated Red Fox. Red Fox made 43-plus albums. That's a hell of a lot of jokes. But America wasn't ready for Red Fox. They said he was too blue. But Red Fox taught me how to be myself. Performing in High Sienna Hotel in Las Vegas, he told me, he said, you're a funny guy, but you don't want to be funny. You want to be liked. I didn't understand what he meant at that particular time. But being dedicated and finding out, it takes time. Because everyone kept telling me, especially being a minority, everyone kept telling me you had to be like Bill Cosby. Bill Cosby. Then when Richard Pryor got hot, oh, you ain't no Richard Pryor. Then Eddie Murphy came along. He had a 10-year draw period where there was no minorities, black comics, after Richard Pryor. Then Eddie Murphy came along. Everybody started telling me I had to be Eddie Murphy. Well, in 1987, I did a show in Chicago, and I was performing, and I wasn't at my best at that particular time, and a heckler kept heckling me. He was heckling everybody the whole entire night, and it was my turn. Everybody was really scared to go up because this guy was a big guy, big redneck. I mean, he had a table full of cats, and they were just intimidating everybody. Well, I went up, and I was not intimidated, and he said a few words. I kept trying to do my normal act. I got off my normal act, and I got on him, and the place went crazy. And it was more or less of being elated that I stood up to him, and my style changed at that particular time. Well, I got a standing ovation. The next night, I came back to work being my old self. And when I walked through the door before I performed that next night, it was a group of people. They said, "There he is. That's the guy I was telling you about, girl. He is funny. When did you see him tonight?" Well, I went back to my old style. And everybody was looking at me like they was having prayer.
Now, when you were getting started, did you play different kinds of audiences, some black audiences, some white audiences, some integrated audiences?
I performed whatever there was people. I started on the L's of Chicago. In the 70s, I used to ride the L's and perform from 95th Street all the way downtown. I used to do the subways.
Wait. No, in New York subways have been almost like performance art, where every 5 minutes someone else is coming in and either doing some performance or asking for money or telling you that they're, you know, threatening you unless you give them money. But there's always something. So how would you do it? You just walk into a car and start doing your act?
No, I never walked to a car. No, I never did that. What I used to do was, during the rush hour, people go to work, I would get on the end of the L, and I would go and I would always watch the news and I would read the paper and see what was going on in the city. And I would get on, and people would first look at me like I was a bum until they got acquainted with me and they got familiar with me. And they saw, this guy, this is the L comedian. And I used to make people laugh, and I had a box. And people used to put money in the box. Then when I got to Lake Street, I used to go way down in the subway. And as people be going back and forth, I would stand there. And I had this little microphone, little beatbox thing. And it was like my speaker. And I would tell jokes. And I would talk about current events, things that happened in the neighborhood. And plus, I would do little characters and stuff that I had back then. And people would throw money in the box. I made $300 to $400 a day.
Wow, that's great.
But I was
probably more
happy
than some of the comedy cups played.
Yeah, but I wasn't happy.
I
wasn't happy at all because I felt like I was begging. I felt like a bum.
Right.
I wanted to be legitimized. In 1977, I went to the clubs.
Did you find that white audiences and black audiences reacted differently to your material or reacted differently in general?
Well, they act different in general because white audience come to be entertained. Black audience want to entertain you. And white audience are more cordial, more respectful of the artist. And even if you're bad, I mean, you know, the audience has changed. I'm talking about the audience back then. The audience has changed all the way around the table now. But white audience was more cordial to you. Black audience, they just tell you like it is. If you suck, you suck. And they don't want to hear you. You ain't getting nothing but 2 or 3 minutes. You come out the gate with that old sorry stuff, you're in a world of trouble.
Well, how would you get driven off the stage if you weren't working?
I refused to get driven off the stage.
Okay.
When I died the death of a pilot, I stayed up there. And that was something I think that helped me to this day. I see a lot of cats run. I seen that 3 minutes become an hour. I seen that hour, man, when you're on the road, be like 30 minutes. You be like, where did the time go? And that's a different transformation. Those are growing pains. You know, you have to work at your craft. You know, you don't come out hitting the ball right away. You might get a tip here and there. You know, I've done great for 2 weeks, and then a whole month when the slump ain't make nobody laugh. I've been through all of that.
My guest is comic Bernie Mac, star of the new Fox sitcom, The Bernie Mac Show. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is comic Bernie Mac, star of the new Fox sitcom, The Bernie Mac Show. Now, you opened for acts like Gladys Knight, The Temptations, The OJs. What's it like to open for big-name music acts? What were the pros and cons of that?
Well, the pros were that you made it, that you were on your way and you were pretty good to be there. The cons were, if you believe that stuff, you're in a world of trouble. You know, that's one reason why I don't hear the voices. You know, you can be up today and down tomorrow. Comedy is something that, you know, you have to really, really have it in your heart. Something that you just don't wake up and say you want to do or be. Comedy is something that's have to be in your bones because it's you against the world. In boxing, you have single activity, but a judge can determine your fate or a referee can stop the fight early. Tennis, hey, a bad call here and there can determine your fate. But comedy, you have no excuses. It's you and the mic and a bunch of people who don't give a doggone about you. And if once you get out there, you're on your own. And that's one thing that I love about comedy. I love that kind of pressure.
I guess the things that really made you famous were the Def Comedy Jam and the Kings of Comedy tour that Spike Lee made the movie of. So what was it like when things started to change and after the original Kings of Comedy was released?
Well, let me tell you exactly how it was. I made a name for myself in Chicago because I refused to go to Los Angeles because that's where everyone told me I had to go. They told me that in order for me to go and be a comedian, that I had to go to Los Angeles. And the time that I went to Los Angeles, they treated me like dirt. It was a clique. It was almost like a fraternity. You had to be with this organization or you had to be with that organization. I actually hit every comedy club in Los Angeles, and I wasn't connected. So I made an oath to myself that L.A. was going to come to me. And I did that. I formulated a comedy circuit here. I went through the white club system, and I didn't make it. They told me that I wasn't funny. They told me I had to do this. The politics clicked in, and I was never a part of the clique. Well, I made a name for myself. I just started doing a little radio subbing in for Todd Joyner, Dub Banks on GCI V103, and I made a little laugh for myself. I was at the Cotton Club on Monday. I was at the Dayton Game on Tuesday. I was at Shit Coco's on Wednesday. I was at the Robin 500 on Thursday, AKA on Friday. I did 67 shows around the city on Saturday, and I was at the club on Spices on the north side on Sunday. So I was working 7 days a week plus doing my regular working job. Then from there, all the comedy clubs started calling back for me. The black comedy clubs started to reopen. I started working both clubs. I got very popular in all the club circuit. Well, Def Jam came on and they came in Atlanta City and I was headlining 6 shows. Talent coordinator named Bob Sumner came to one of the shows. I had 3 shows that night and he told me, he said they'd been calling me and told me they was doing a new television show and they wanted me to come on. Well, he came to Atlanta and he saw me and he said, man, you are on. We want you on. I said, great. Because I looked at it as an opportunity to showcase myself to the world on HBO. Then in 1997, they came to me with the Kings of Comedy. And what the Kings of Comedy did was it put me in an arena where a lot of people who didn't know me got to know me. We was doing 24,000, 18,000 seaters for 3 years. And that broadened my audience. And the rest is history.
You're in the remake of Ocean's 11, the new versions of it. Who do you play in it?
I play a character of the name of Frank Catton, who's a con man. I'm the cat that enables everyone to get into the casinos because I know the casinos like the back of my hand. I play as a car dealer. I'm a con man. But I get the maps and I lay everything out and I get us in and out of all these casinos and that's my job.
Were you a fan of the Rat Pack and specifically of Sammy Davis Jr.?
Oh, when no
you
question. Were young? Yeah. No question. Troy Bishop, Peter Lawford, Sammy. I thought those cats were Dean Martin. Dean Martin had a certain suave about him that was indescribable.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly speaking, he sang better than Frank Sinatra. Frank Sinatra, I can think of a numerous
No way.
Oh, please.
No.
Frank Sinatra is overrated to me.
No.
But I like his persona. I like what he stood for, and I like the respect that he had off stage. His presence was more powerful than on. Frank Sinatra was mediocre to me. Andy Williams, Mel Torme, Dean Martin, I'll tear his tail up any day. Those were my favorites. And Dean Martin was funny. Dean Martin had a certain pizzazz about himself that was just unbelievable. Frank Sinatra just had that persona. He had that he had that halo on him that people was afraid to touch. And there's nothing wrong with that. I think he's very talented. I love the Rat Pack, but that's just my personal opinion. That's my favorite. I can name some more. Barry Como, much better singer.
Now, you're my guest, so I'm not going to argue with you about Andy Williams being a better singer than Frank Sinatra.
Okay.
But if we meet on the street sometime,
you know what?
We'll talk more about it.
That's a beautiful thing. I got my candy. Oh, he is all right. And I tell you what, whenever you meet me, we got a debate.
You bet. I have strong feelings about Sinatra.
I bring in facts with me.
Okay, I've got strong feelings about Andy Williams, too. I never really liked him.
Okay, that's all right. But he beat Frank.
All right.
All right, baby.
Bernie Mac. He stars in the new Fox sitcom, The Bernie Mac Show. He also has a new book called I Ain't Scared of You. Jazz impresario and record producer Norman Granz died Thursday at the age of 83. He founded the Verve and Pablo record labels and created the touring concert series Jazz at the Philharmonic. He recorded many of jazz's greatest stars, including Lester Young, Charlie Parker, Duke Ellington, Sarah Vaughan, and Ella Fitzgerald. We'll close this half hour with one of Norman Granz's classic sessions, Charlie Parker with Strings.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. And Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Sometimes I Dream in Italian by Rita Cerisi, a novel of Sisters by the author of Pink Slip. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Russell Simmons, the entrepreneur of hip-hop. He co-founded Def Jam Records, has produced movies and TV shows, and even has his own line of clothing. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Russell Simmons, is perhaps the most famous and successful hip-hop entrepreneur. He started off producing rap shows in 1976. He managed Curtis Blow, who had one of the first rap hits, Christmas Rapping. In 1985, Simmons co-founded Def Jam Records, which signed such artists as LL Cool J, The Beastie Boys, The Fresh Prince, and Public Enemy. Simmons produced the movies The Nutty Professor and How to Be a Player and the HBO TV series Def Comedy Jam, and he has his own clothing and accessories line called Fat Farm. Russell Simmons tells his story in his new memoir, Life and Def, which was written with Nelson George. I asked Simmons what his reaction was in 1979 when he heard this, the first commercial rap record, Rapper's Delight, by the Sugar Hill Gang. The hip, 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 hop, you don't stop. Rock it out, baby, bubba to the boogity bang, bang, the boogie to the boogity beat. Now what you hear is not a test, I'm rapping to the beat. And me, 1979, that record came out, and I was very distraught because I didn't know any better, and I had a record on the shelf by the name of Christmas Rapping, which was the first release that I was involved with by Curtis Blow. And so, you know, I didn't have the vision to know that this was an eye-opener for America or opened the door for me. I just thought that these guys had stolen my, you know, not my idea, but I had a record on the shelf, and I wanted it to be the first rap record. So when I heard it, I kind of, not only was I upset, but so was the whole hip-hop community, because there was a group of artists, DJ Hollywood, Eddie Cheever, the great Grandmaster Flash, Curtis Blow, Love Bug Starsky. These guys were the stars of that genre, and they were performing artists. Now, here's a recording artist record by people who were not popular, who borrowed ideas and rhymes from this community and put it on record. So we were all, like, bummed out because we thought these guys had stolen our music, our ideas, and our, you know, our culture, and they were selling it, and we weren't. So I didn't realize that Rapper's Delight was the greatest thing that could have happened to me. How was it the greatest thing?
Well, because it allowed people to understand that there was profit in rap music. And then it gave Curtis Blow an opportunity to put out his record. I had a Curtis Blow record on the shelf. Again, that record was named Christmas Rappin'. It plays every Christmas right now.
Why don't we play it now? Introduce it for us. Tell us something about what you think made this record special.
Well, it was probably the second rap record to come out. And it was, you know, a very, very commercial version of hip-hop, but it certainly it was honest. It was a hip-hopper who was from Harlem. It was the real thing and had built a legitimate following on his own as a performing artist. And it was actually very timely. And every Christmas, it's still timely. You know, it's pretty interesting rhymes. And whenever I hear it, I get goosebumps because that was my first experience being in the record business, which was something, of course, I aspired to and, you know, only dreamed about.
Okay, so this is Christmas Rapping, and it's Russell Simmons' first record production and Curtis Blow's first recording.
"'Twas the night before Christmas, and all through the
house..." Hold it now, wait, hold it. That's played out. Hit it! "Don't you give me all that jive about things you wrote before I was alive. 'Cause this ain't 1823, ain't even 1970. Now I'm the guy named Curtis Blow, and Christmas is one thing I know. So every year, just about this time, I celebrate it with a rhyme. Gonna shake it, gonna bake it, gonna make it good. Gonna rock, shock, knock it through your neighborhood. Gonna read, gonna sing it till it's understood. My rapping about to happen like a knee you were slapping, or I thought you'd been tapping on a hunk of wood. Bought a red suited dude with a friendly attitude and a sleigh full of goodies for the people on the block. Got a long white beard, maybe looks kind of weird, and if you ever see him, he can give you quite a shock."
That's Curtis Blow's Christmas Rapping, produced by my guest Russell Simmons, who has a new memoir, which is called Life and Death. Now, when you started getting successful, and when some of the performers you were producing, like Curtis Blow, started getting successful, Run-DMC, it meant money. Making money quickly at a young age can be a very good thing. It could also be a very destructive thing, because sometimes people aren't prepared to deal with that kind of money, and it gets them into more trouble than it has benefits. Looking back, what are some of the things you think you did right and wrong when you started coming into money?
Well, I think that I already was like a big old druggie. Like, whatever drug came my way, I took. I was already running the street, the success or the money, the results of the success, I don't think it damaged me too much. You know, I mean, it gave me opportunity and access. Some of the access was a little bit of a problem. But I think that mostly I had a good time, and I think that the money for me was, you know, just gave me more incentive in a way. It was kind of a measure of success. But I did see many artists who got addicted to drugs and whose careers suffered because of this quick access and this amount of money that was, you know, for them an unreasonable amount of money for the work that they did. People did the work for the love of it, and when they started to get a lot of money for it, they lost focus, many of us. And so, at some point, you know, I just straightened up, and it was kind of an evolution, but it was just, I don't think that the money for me was a problem. I mean, it gave me the opportunity to get an apartment. I remember when Christmas Rapping was a hit, for instance, the greatest success that I can remember to date is that I got a record out. I got a chance to get on a plane and go to Amsterdam, which for me was an amazing experience. I had never been on a plane at all. I went to Amsterdam in 1979 with Curtis Blow. We were treated like, well, we thought we were kings. We got to go to Amsterdam and perform, and we saw people, you know, from other countries, not only Amsterdam, but we went to France, Paris, France specifically, and these people watched us perform, and here we were in this big world with our own music. And when I came back to New York, I was moving into my own apartment. That apartment is probably no bigger than the studios I'm here recording from. But I was in the record business, which is what I wanted to be, and that was a tremendous success, just the ability to go to work every day in an industry that I loved.
As a teenager, you were dealing drugs and making money that way. Did you learn anything in the business of dealing drugs that you were able to apply when you became a real businessman?
Well, I can tell you that it inspired me to buy for one and sell for two. And that's something that in the black community, we didn't have very many role models who are entrepreneurs. It's just now that hip-hop is inspiring so many young people, many of whom are not so educated or sophisticated, but are driven by incentive and, I mean, by love of music and art, and who own their own. And there are big margins in some of these businesses, and they just go to work every day without, you know, a business school background, without a degree from Harvard or wherever. They just go to work from heart. It's something that was not instilled in kids in the black community. Their job was to be a doctor, maybe, but be a teacher, probably. Just to go to school was the goal. You know, rappers rap now about being CEOs. They don't even rap sometimes about how good a rapper they are. They rap a lot more about how much they can stack money and how they do it, you know, how they run their businesses.
Now, do you think of yourself as having done business any differently with Def Jam than you saw business being done in the major record labels that you had tried to deal with?
Absolutely. We had this vision that these artists were long-term, that they had images of that had to be protected, that they were not going to be exploitative in terms of the kind of music they put out. We weren't going to change their music so it would sell more. We weren't going to sell them out or allow them to sell themselves out. We wanted to remind them to keep their integrity and promote that. We wanted to make sure that their images, their visual images, were out in the street, not just their music. There was a lot of work that we did that was different from what major labels would have done, and it gave us an edge over them, because even now, LL Cool J, who was our first act, and we recorded his record in 84, is recording a new record, and his last record was a platinum-selling record. Even now, there's a new Run DMC record being recorded, and their first record was recorded in 1982. Beastie Boys are still recording. There's a new Public Enemy record. Slick Rick is still coming out. There's a new EPMD record. These are the bands we started with. You can always fool people one time or a few times, but to really have a long-standing career, you have to connect with them in some real place.
My guest is hip-hop mogul Russell Simmons. He has a new memoir called Life and Def. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is hip-hop mogul Russell Simmons. He co-founded Def Jam Records, has produced movies and TV shows, and created the clothing and accessories company Fat Farm. Have you ever been concerned about the promotion of a gangster lifestyle through rap, making it cool to think of women as bitches, making it cool to think of, shooting people in drive-bys and the gang life?
You know, I'm often asked this question.
I figured. And,
and people are always surprised to know that I'm really proud of all of what rap stands for today. And I believe that what people say in their closed doors, they're shocked to hear it on the radio. They're shocked to hear a reflection of this reality, broadcast. I heard a senator say at the hearings on the Marketing Accountability Act, and Senator Thompson, a Republican senator, said he thought that every 15-year-old boy should see Saving Private Ryan, because he thought that if they all saw that, they'd know a lot about the war and about, that lifestyle that you have to, or that attitude that you have to have in order to live through war, and it was important. I said, well, in that case, every 15-year-old kid must hear a Snoop Dogg record, because that's a war going on down the block. And that's not 50 years ago, that's right now. And that's something that it's very important. When they say F the police, or when they said it in Compton in 1985, that was such an important record. I remember signing a band in L.A., and they were just nice kids, basically, but lived in a horrible part of L.A. And they came to visit me at the Beverly Hills Hotel, and they asked me how to get home. I said, what do you mean, how do you get home? How'd you? And I said, they're afraid of the police. I said, well, why are you afraid of the police? What are you carrying? Do you have guns? Do you have drugs? No, we don't have anything. We're just afraid of the police. He's a 20-year-old man, scared to drive in Beverly Hills. Almost all the records that people perceive as gangster records are about people frustrated who don't perceive themselves as having any other opportunity, and it's a description of their lifestyle more than it is an endorsement of it. And so that's something that, people who listen closely to the music can tell. And people from the outside, all they can hear is the language. Well, real language is okay by me. And descriptions of real situations and a real reflection of our society, a part of our society, is important by me.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. I think at the same time, though, all of that became a kind of style. And it was a style that was equated with being authentic. So if you wanted to make a record and sound authentic, you had to do it in that style, too, even if it wasn't really your style.
My brother's a Reverend Run. His record's his last hit, he hadn't made a hit in about 5-7 years. It was called Down With The King. It's about down with God. LL Cool J has never made a gangster record. DMX talks about heart and soul. Jay-Z talks about the street, but he also talks about how could he ever survive getting out of it, and how could he talks about how happy he is and thrilled anybody should be, and he's Will Smith, I think, is the biggest rapper in the world. Lauryn Hill may be the second biggest rapper in the world. They're not gangsters. I think that people make more, it's more newsworthy, but not salesworthy always. So you may talk about gangster rap because it offends you, but I think there's a lot of good in even those records, but there is a good balance in rap. Although I aspire, as a person who can promote cultural initiatives on my own, to push more social and political rap records, I get what's real, whatever is honest.
I know what you're saying, and I don't want to argue that all rap is gangster rap, because I know that that's not true. But on the other hand, I just wonder how you feel sometimes if you see, an 8-year-old kid who's, listening to rap and mouthing things that they don't even understand what it means about, gangsters and bitches and hoes and guns and drugs.
Well, 8-year-old kids watch the news, ma'am, in all fairness. Sometimes you say a sex record, is bad. Somebody says something about sex, but you turn on 6 o'clock and it's implied and it's shown all the time. Not the physical. I mean, certainly a record.
But I'm still asking you how you feel about it when you see it with rap. The kids just start to aspire to.
You're putting something on me that you don't put on the news, that you don't put on daytime television. You're putting a greater pressure on these artists than you are on daytime mainstream television. And these records do have parental advisory stickers on them. You watch violent movies, really violent movies, primetime. So I just think that, you know, this is kind of a racial thing to some degree. You know, it's like we don't like, maybe language bothers you. I'm not offended by language. I'm not too worried about my child hearing language. The ideas I'm concerned with, I will talk to my child about. But my child will see and hear these ideas everywhere.
The same questions have been asked about violent movies and a lot of television and so on. And I'm not myself trying to pass judgment here. I'm just asking you if you have ever been in the position of thinking, gee, somebody's taking the wrong message away from this. They're taking it too literally. They're taking it at face value. They're aspiring to a kind of street warfare that they're not forced into doing. I mean, they're not even...
Well, I certainly know that people take a lot of culture and a lot of reality and twist it the way it suits them, whether it's a James Cagney movie, an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, whether it's a rap record. But a lot of these kids, you know, they need counseling and parents to work with them and support in a different way. But there are so many influences on kids, so many positive and so many that could be made positive or made negative, depending on where the kid's mindset is at that time. And I'm hopeful that more good will come from rap's description of the condition of the suffering people in the communities than bad. But I certainly don't, you know, believe that the artists are responsible for the actions of the people who buy their music.
One of the things that you have now is a fashion company, clothes and colognes. It's called Fat Farm. How long have you been in that end of things?
Well, that company is now celebrating, well, will be in spring, and we're working on a collection now for fall 2002. Will be a 10-year anniversary.
Was it that long?
That's right. And so Fat Farm is celebrating its 10-year anniversary. It's a pretty interesting story because when we started Fat Farm, there were no partners and no one really understood our vision. And we said in our first campaign, classic American flavor. And it was kind of a joke to a lot of the retailers, certainly the buyers from Bloomingdale's and Macy's. And they'd look, classic American flavor, what do you mean? I mean, if you have to think about the fact that Ralph Lipschitz had to change his name to be that. I mean, because obviously no Jew could be the American dream. And for me, classic American flavor, and there was not one black person owner in the entire Magic, which was a convention where you sell clothes. But classic American flavor and the kind of clothes that I aspired to sell didn't fit into what they referred to as an ethnic clothing division they were starting to develop. And that meant low expectations and limited budgets and a small, and the idea of an American company, I mean, so we couldn't sit next to the Ralphs or Polo or Tommy's, and that really was the case. And now, 10 years later, the company went last year from $140 to $220 million this year. And especially, as you know, this economy has slowed, and most companies have gone backwards or, you know, or still, but our company still grew a tremendous amount this year. Like I said earlier, there weren't any black companies, and there was no appreciation. They really thought that we had an ethnic clothing company. And I was like, what is that? I have pink Argyle sweaters. What is ethnic about our company? And it was just a lack. I mean, it's the same as I have an advertising agency, which represents Coca-Cola and Cavassier and many other companies, and they still say sometimes, well, we're an ethnic advertising company. I said, what does that mean? I'm an American. I've been born here my whole life. But there were many ethnic companies. There are many urban advertising companies. And that was all that was available at one time. In my film business, you know, there's not one film, black film producer. I was when I made Nutty Professor, and they pointed out to me that was the only black person who was a film producer not making urban films. Just like BET playing our videos. When MTV played our videos, it was like a you know, something brand new. So now rap, we've replaced ourselves. Right now we have the number one record in America. But before this number one record in America, which is the DMX record, we replaced our own number one record, which was the Jay-Z record, And before that, we replaced our other number one record with the Ja Rule. And that's not the black chart. That's the American pop chart. 80% of my records are sold to non-African Americans. I don't look on the black chart anymore, although it still exists.
My guest is hip-hop mogul Russell Simmons. He has a new memoir called Life and Death. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is hip-hop mogul Russell Simmons. He co-founded Def Jam Records, has produced movies and TV shows, and created the clothing and accessories company Fat Farm. In June of this year, there was a hip-hop summit that you helped organize, and I think one of the things that happened there was that you started a political action committee. What do you want to accomplish with it? What are the issues that you want to put across in Washington?
Well, one of the things that we do, and we're funded by the RIAA and the record industry and individual companies, independent companies, is protect us in Washington. As you remember, there was a real aggressive attack, which was newsworthy before September 11th, on hip-hop, whether it's Senator Lieberman's Marketing Accountability Act or the FCC suing radio stations, one for a poet, and the other one for an Eminem record. They were suing radio stations over music. And the Marketing Accountability Act was something that threatened the very foundation of our freedom of speech and our music business. So, of course, we want to protect that industry. But also, we want to inspire a higher level of consciousness amongst many rappers. And so, at that summit, we talked, you know, Puffy and Wyclef, and Mary J. Blige, and Queen Latifah, and Will Smith, and many rappers came. And we had meetings about A&R, which is the artist repertoire business, of getting the truth out of artists in case there were some artists who were not only telling the truth, but were, as you suggested earlier, talking more about the street than they were living. You know, talk about what your honest interpretation of life is. Give us the truth. It will sell more. So we had a seminar about that. We had another seminar about what we were going to do to address the Marketing Accountability Act, and that we all agreed at that time that we were going to make sure we not only label the records, but we make sure in radio and television ads that we would make it clear these records, some records, were parental advisory. And the third thing we did was we had a speech by Minister Louis Farrakhan, who was a big draw in the hip-hop community, as you know or don't know. And his speech was, I think, very inspirational to a lot of them. Kwasi and Fume from the NAACP came. Hugh Price from the Urban League came. Martin Luther King from the SCLC came. Cornel West and all the other intellectuals from you know, Michael Dyson and many other people came and participated. And the idea was to get the adults, because it was their job to reach out to the young people instead of turning their back. You have great organizations like the Urban League that have millions of dollars and great infrastructures that are not connected to the people in the community, or not to the young people in the community. And even Kwasi and Fume, who is a real advocate of working with young people, has had to fight his board of directors in order to use young people in the way that, to reach other young people. I remember when Ben Chavis, who now works for and is the president of the Hip Hop Action Network, was the president of the NAACP. And we did a Rap the Vote campaign with Run DMC. The people at the NAACP were furious. Said, why would you use these kids to reach these people?
Does it ever surprise you that you're not younger self anymore? That, like, you've been in this business a long time, and you're in your what, mid-40s now?
That's right. I'm 44.
And it's such a kind of youth-oriented business, the whole hip-hop business. Yeah.
I think I feel young. I don't go to every party. I don't take drugs and go crazy. In fact, I'm a vegan. I don't even eat animals.
Uh-huh.
You know, or any animal product. I won't even eat a piece of fish. But I'm happy, and I don't judge what I've done or what young people do. You know, I think God shined on all of what you consider evil and even good. And I think what you're inspired to do, I mean, I have a very funny philosophy about judgment, a very strong opinion about judgment, although, you know, I just think let it be and, you know, and see what's good in it. And I think that I love young people. I love their spirit because they're able to see what's God in everyone much quicker than some of the older, mostly more rigid people. Young people, it's their job to lead us somewhere more positive. That's why I work so hard on Rap to Vote. That's why I work so hard to inspire young people to speak up, to pick up a newspaper, not only to destroy what their parents gave them, but to give them a new direction. So I love young people. I feel young mostly. I'm in better shape than I was 25 years ago. So I think I'm okay, and I don't feel too bad about it. In fact, I think that I love the place I am in my life right now.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Russell Simmons has a new memoir called Life and Deaf. His Deaf Poetry Jam series begins on HBO December 14th. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Clap your hands, everybody, if you got what it takes. Because I'm Curtis Blow, and I want you to know that these are the breaks. On a bus, brakes on a car, brakes to make you a superstar, brakes to win and brakes to lose, but these here brakes rock your shoes, and these are the brakes, break it up, break it up, break it up,
support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, promoting excellence in journalism worldwide and investing in the vitality of 26 U.S. communities. And Vintage Books, paperback publishers of The True History of the Kelly Gang, the new novel by Peter Carey. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Bosnian film director Danis Tanović. During the war, he was the Bosnian Army's cameraman, documenting the war for the Army Archive. He's directed his first feature film, No Man's Land, about three soldiers trapped in a trench between enemy lines. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.